Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When leading suffragists of the early 20th century looked for an egalitarian society at work, they visited Native American tribes that gave women equal rights with men. But as the battles for enfranchisement in the U.S. wore on, women of color, African Americans, and Native Americans were largely sidelined by racism. Led mostly by white women of means, the suffrage movement needed their support, but shunned the active participation of minority women. 100 years after the 19th Amendment became federal law, black suffragists such as Ida B. Wells, Hallie Quinn Brown, and Mary Church Terrell have largely been forgotten. We're talking about the final weeks before Tennessee became the 36th state to ratify the amendment 100 years ago, and who brokered those deals and who was cast aside. Journalist Elaine Weiss is the author of the 2018 book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How did the popular narrative that we associate with the women's movement come to sanitize just how messy, undemocratic, and racist the process was? And I suppose I could ask you that question about almost anything in our country these days.
True enough. Well, I think the larger answer to that is we don't know anything about the women's suffrage movement, much less the details. I think if you look at most standard history books, K-12, and I hope this is going to change soon, mm-hmm. but I think the version that we got was pretty much a sentence or two. And it usually was something like, in 1848, American women asked for the vote at Seneca Falls, and in 1920, they got it. And if we think of the movement at all, it's usually two women, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And they did everything. They invented the movement. They ran the movement. They took it over the finish line with the 19th Amendment. And all of that, of course, is crazy. It was a movement of more than seven decades, of three generations, of tireless activists all over the country. So it's been kind of simplified and flattened and condensed and made meaningless in terms of one of the major civil rights campaigns of our history. So I think there's lots of things we don't know and have not been told in a popular way or in our education about how this movement achieved enormous change.
As I was reading your book, I kept thinking they could have created a whole political party. They were so organized.
Oh, in fact, they considered doing that. They absolutely did. They were amazing. They were amazing. They begin as grassroots activists, as movements often do, out of their own personal experience. And they organize in small groups and then scattered groups and then larger groups and become an enormous push for change. And they had to, in that process, learn all the political levers that needed to be pulled to achieve what they wanted to achieve. And again, it was a movement to gain the vote, but that was, I mean, we can go into the whole history of it, but that becomes the kind of the turnkey. That's the key to achieving all the other legal and social changes that are needed to make women more equal in American society. So when we think about the suffrage movement, it is a legal, it's a constitutional change, but it's also a societal change that they're after.
We are approaching the summer of 2020, which brings us to the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. My guest is Elaine Weiss. She's a journalist and author of the 2018 book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. That's what we're talking about this hour with later on, quite a bit of emphasis on the role of women of color in the movement, how they were sidelined, but nonetheless necessary. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-299. 928513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to talk about the optimism and how they sustained it for, so, as you mentioned, 7 decades. I don't think that they could have fought the Revolutionary War or the Civil War for that long. Mm-hmm. And obviously those were actual wars of, you know, of lives. But still, to maintain the optimism that they had. And I can't remember if it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who you quoted saying she wasn't going to actually vote until she could vote for a woman for president.
Oh, no, no, no. Okay. That's another.
Okay,
another,
it's good. Yeah, I didn't think
not
so.
Not anyone as seminal as Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
But people thought that. I mean, they had very high hopes, and look at us now, you know.
That's very true.
So how did they sustain the optimism?
Well, that's one of the wonderful, almost spiritual aspects of the struggle, and they truly believed that this was their mission, and that this was going to make a better America, a better democracy, and that they were owed it, that they were citizens. And so, I mean, the persistence that they display is really, I think, one of the lessons of the entire movement. How these women were disappointed, disillusioned, betrayed, defeated time and time and time again. There's a rough count that over the course of the 7 decades, and of course it's kind of longer than that, and then it will extend beyond 1920. We'll discuss that later. But in that time, there are approximately 900 campaigns at the state, local, or national level. And that's getting a suffrage amendment on the city council docket. It's getting a change in state law. I mean, there are all these different kinds of campaigns that the suffragists had to wage in order to build up to getting a constitutional amendment passed. So their persistence, their belief in their cause, and they're just kind of getting back up and dusting themselves off and keep going is, I think, really important for us today when, you know, we lose one skirmish and it's kind of one and done. I've done that. I signed that petition. It's over. I'm through with that cause. You know, there certainly the civil rights campaigns of the mid-20th century still going on. You do have to have that sense of hope and courage to keep going even after you've been defeated. I think it's an important lesson.
But as you write the book, as you write in the book, that summer of 1920 was critical. Tennessee was critical. The feeling was that it was not going to be sustainable for much longer.
Yes, and I think they were right. The suffragists saw that the nation was swinging on that historical pendulum that we know so well, and it was becoming a more conservative country. It was becoming more regressive in its social policies. Immigration was a big issue in the 1920 elections. It was. They could see that the progressive era was coming to an end, that the nation had just come out of an ugly, terrible war, what we call World War I, and the nation wanted to be more isolationist, didn't want to join the League of Nations, wanted to withdraw into itself and keep its borders closed, and that would happen. That would happen soon after. So the suffragists are correct that if they don't get it now, if they aren't able to capitalize on the role women played in World War I, which was an extraordinary and a new role for women, if they weren't able to capitalize on the energy of the presidential election in 1920, they really might not see it come to pass. That amendment might flail. And not reach its threshold of then 36 states, 3/4 of the states, and there were 48 then. And of course, those of us who've lived with the Equal Rights Amendment know that can happen. Mm-hmm. It's very possible that a constitutional amendment could get within striking distance and then just stall. And we just saw a few weeks ago that the Equal Rights Amendment, which, by the way, is the direct descendant of the 19th Amendment. It's written by Alice Paul. It is introduced in Congress in 1923. So it's been around for 97 years. So I think the suffragists were very correct that this was a pivotal moment. And if they lost Tennessee, which was the kind of last best hope for getting the amendment ratified in time, they may not see it in their lifetime.
What was going on in the rest of the world? Because I think that some of those the suffragist leaders were actually, you know, in other countries talking with leadership in those movements there as well.
Oh, yes. So women's suffrage was an international movement.
Yeah.
It was not just in the U.S. It was not just in Great Britain. And what's so interesting is that one of the suffrage leaders here in America, a woman named Carrie Chapman Catt, who's one of my main characters. Mm-hmm. She's there in Tennessee. But she is also the president of the International Women's Suffrage Association, which has, I think it's 50 nations are represented. And so this is an international body which meets periodically, and they swap stories, they swap strategies, they support one another because it's a very lonely crusade in every country, and 26 nations give their women the vote before America does. I think that's a sobering thought, that we were not in the vanguard in this, much as we're not in the vanguard of women chief executives. Most democracies have had women as their presidents or prime ministers mm-hmm. long before, and kind of look at us and say, what is the big deal? So I think it's a good lesson for us to look and see that we were kind of in the bottom of the pack of major countries who were giving women the vote.
What and is there a clear one of the things that our country has grappled with and still does, and it comes up in all the time, is racism. Is the history of not only the enslavement of humans for cheap labor or free labor, but mm-hmm. also, the taking of lands from Native Americans. That's kind of all about who we are and our history, and how much of that is wrapped up. That is not a history that Europeans, and the other democracies, of the great democracies of the world, necessarily had to deal with.
Well, yes, that's true. They had empires far away. So they did deal with that, but at a remove.
Right.
It's certainly part of the national character, so we shouldn't dismiss that.
Of course.
But yes, I mean, the race issue is part of the suffrage movement from the very beginning, and in good ways and bad, because you can't talk about American history without talking about race. So I think it's naive to think that this enormous reform movement would not be shaped by what it has been a racist society, and trying to deal with that on several different levels.
We are talking about the history of the 19th Amendment today. My guest is Elaine Weiss. She's a journalist and author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. If you have a question or comment about the topic, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When leading suffragists of the early 20th century looked for an egalitarian society at work, they visited Native American tribes that gave women equal rights with men. But as the battles for enfranchisement in the U.S. wore on, women of color, African Americans, and Native Americans were largely sidelined by racism. Led mostly by white women of means, the suffrage movement needed their support but shunned the active participation of minority women. 100 years after the 19th Amendment became federal law, black suffragists such as Ida B. Wells, Hallie Quinn Brown, and Mary Church Terrell have largely been forgotten. We're talking about that time when Tennessee became the 36th state to ratify the amendment. Who brokered the deals and who was cast aside? Still with us is journalist Elaine Weiss, author of the 2018 book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Megan Wood is director of cultural resources at the Ohio History Connection. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
What was going on in Ohio in 1920 at that time? What had happened here?
So Ohio had quickly ratified the amendment in 1919, but it's the center of the presidential campaign with Governor Cox and Senator Harding right in Ohio gearing up to be the presidential candidates. And, you know, both sides are seeking influence from them on the issue of suffrage. And, you know, there's definitely hot and cold moments on both of them playing the political sides on how the tide is going to turn.
We're talking about, Elaine Weiss, are we not, something like 26 or 27 million potential voters, right?
Correct. And Ohio kind of goes, again, has a pretty, as I recall, strong anti-suffrage movement, and it is, I think the ratification was being challenged. Am I correct on that? The ratification was being challenged to have to go to referendum.
Okay, Megan Wood?
Well, you know, there was earlier attempts, like in 1917, for women to be able to vote, like in presidential primaries, and then that was struck down in the courts. But once we finally got to 1919, I think that there were challenges, but the tide had turned a little bit in Ohio, you know, being as a swing state as we always are, that we tend to go back and forth on these issues with majority.
Right. And one of the things I found so fascinating about Ohio, and I did sort of mentally live in the state because the presidential candidates, the campaign, the 1920 campaign is in some ways centered in Ohio with both candidates from Ohio. What's so interesting about the tension in Ohio, there is some racial tension about black citizens being able to vote in especially in the major cities, but there's also the corporate influence. And that's something we just never think about in terms of women's suffrage. Like, what do corporations have to do with this? They have a lot to do with it. And Ohio being a very, where the liquor industry is strong.
And prohibition.
Yes. So prohibition's already in effect in 1920. Mm-hmm. But the liquor industry is still pumping money into the anti-suffrage movement in order to keep women away from the ballot box in 1920 with the hopes that the enabling acts, the enforcement of prohibition won't be as stringent. They fear that if women are involved in the political mix in Ohio, that enforcement will be more stringent than the industry wants. So you have this really interesting dynamic going on with corporate money, too.
So let's talk about who... You know, what's happening in Nashville? What's happening in Tennessee at that time, Elaine Weiss? What's going on the ground there?
Well, it turns out that the 36 states, that by the summer of 1920, 35 states have ratified the 19th Amendment, and 36 are needed for full ratification. That's stipulated in the Constitution, 3/4 of the states of the Union. At that time, there are 48 states, so need 36. They have 35. All through the spring of and early summer, there's been nothing but rejections. At this point, most of the southern states have rejected the 19th Amendment, and all on the same grounds, which are states' rights. They don't want Washington to tell them who should be in their voting booths. And, of course, that will be repeated later in the 20th century when the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act ask these questions again. But also, they are not secretive about the fact that they just don't want black women to vote. And the 19th Amendment does give the vote to all women. And they object to that. And that's why the southern states have, for the most part, rejected it. So here comes the last best hope is Tennessee. And they're going to have to fight this battle on southern soil with all of those objections coming to the fore. So it becomes, and of course you have the presidential election, so that is why, as Megan said, you have Senator Harding and Governor Cox in the mix being asked to support one side or the other, and they waffle as best they can. So it really is sort of like the Alamo. This is going to be probably the last battle, and if the anti-suffragists win, it's going to probably tip the momentum, and the 19th Amendment will probably be defeated or at least stranded. And if they win, then 27 million women will be eligible for the vote.
Megan Wood, was there a racial issue in Ohio?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the case. Our very first constitution included black codes like you see in southern states, which not everyone is aware of. And this is also a time of great migration is going on. So mm-hmm. racial tensions are heating up in northern cities. And that's also true in Ohio and Cincinnati. And that the southern strategy of the white suffragist is to try to let southern states know that there'll be more white women, more white people voting than black people if suffrage is granted. And that includes people from Ohio like Harriet Taylor Upton, who is important in the suffrage movement. So it is this complicated patchwork of liberal ideas, but also using the racial tensions of the time to the advantage of the movement.
When they say more white women voting than black women, how could they guarantee something like that? Well, obviously, in numbers, there are more white women, but in some places, there are more black women.
And this is also the time when, post the Reconstruction Amendments in the South, you have Jim Crow laws that are making it de facto unable for African Americans to vote. And with violence and the revival of the Ku Klux Klan at this time as well. So it's kind of like a nod to don't worry, we're not going to be overpowered by the black vote.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about 100 years ago, the final battles to win women the right to vote in the United States also involved elbowing out of the action, women of color, primarily African-American women, but also Native American women. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There were women of color who started to organize their own groups, right, Megan Wood?
Yeah, and there's a few from Ohio. You mentioned Mary Church Terrell, mm-hmm. Who went to Oberlin College and was organizing independent African-American women's groups. And, you know, across even in places like Dayton, you see the organization of black women's clubs and organizations that become things like the YWCA. And then there's also someone like Haley Quinn Brown, who is in Wilberforce for a lot of her career, who is helping to organize the women's colored clubs. And so they're fighting for suffrage for their communities and for their for the needs that are, you know, very dear to them and also grave at this period.
Elaine Weiss?
Oh, yes. There are black women suffragists in every city, in every state, and they are working extremely hard. They understand how important the vote is to their families, to their lives, and they take it very, very seriously. In some places, they are able to work in collaboration with the white suffrage organizations in the town. It's not completely segregated, but we have to realize what the nation was like. Every institution was segregated, absolutely everyone. So it wasn't considered that unusual that this would be, this too would be segregated. You know, the wise are segregated, the just every part of life. So I think we have to understand that that was not considered that unusual. On the other hand, these women in the African-American community are brilliant organizers, and they are fighting it on, you know, of course, two different levels. And people like Church Terrell and Ida B. Wells, and there's, you know, so many others, and I try to talk about the African-American women who are active in Tennessee, and they are extremely important and actually collaborate with the white suffragists. So it's, you can't make blanket statements. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the wonderful things about the centennial, it's given the impetus to do the kind of deep research that has been missing for the most part. There have been scholars, you know, the women you mentioned have been known in the field for a long, long, long time. They are not the new names, but the new names are the local women who were so active, but their records are either don't exist because they weren't kept, they weren't considered as important, or they're in different places. They're not in the history file of women's suffrage in whatever state you're in. They are in the church records. They're in the Black Women's Club records. They are in different places, and they have to be dug more deeply and more broadly. And that's what's happening in many, many, many communities right now. And I think that's one of the most exciting and most valuable parts of this commemoration, is to inspire that kind of deepening and complicating the rather simplistic narrative that we've always known. So I think it's wonderful that these new narratives are being brought into the conversation. I went to a dedication here in Baltimore, where I live, of two houses as an historic marker was put there. It was the homes of two African-American women's suffrage organizers, and it's where their women's suffrage club held their meetings. And, you know, these were women who had not been known, but by you know, looking more deeply about where these records might be, we're finding all kinds of very interesting narratives. And I should also mention that in the case of Native Americans, it's even more complicated in that they were not considered citizens.
Right.
So they are actually, while Black women are covered by the 19th Amendment, and that's something I do want to emphasize, mm-hmm. that it's when Black women are not able to vote after 1920, it is not the 19th Amendment's
right.
fault. It is the fault of the Jim Crow laws, the racist legislatures that are passing these, and it's also the fault of Congress for not enforcing the 19th Amendment, which it has the power to do. Mm-hmm. But Native American women and Asian women are not considered citizens. So they're not covered by the 19th Amendment. So it does get a little more complicated.
Katie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Katie.
Yes, hi. Thank you for bringing up that point about Native American women not being able to vote until 1924, when they were citizens. And I also just kind of wanted to note some of the language we use when we talk about the 19th Amendment. I think people tend to say that the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. But in reality, you had early suffragists like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton claiming that they had those rights. It was mm-hmm. the federal government that was not recognizing those rights. So, I mean, when I write about the 19th Amendment, I like to write that it recognized women's voting rights.
Interesting, because, I mean, in some places, women did vote. right?
Yes, they did. There are records, yeah, that they did vote before that.
Well, you're absolutely right. I don't believe Elizabeth Stanton ever voted. She did run for Congress, however, in 1866, and she thanked her 11 male friends for voting for her. but Susan B. Anthony does vote, along with Sojourner Truth and about 200 other women across the country. They are trying to force a legal test case about that right under the 14th Amendment as citizens to vote. Susan Anthony is made an example. She's arrested, she's tried, and she's convicted of illegal voting in a federal election. So her attempt to make this a legal issue that women already have the vote, this is the whole strategy that the suffrage movement has at this time in the 1870s, is thwarted. And it's out of that experience that they say, okay, you know what? In order to get these restrictions out of state laws, because it's the states that administer voting requirements, we're going to write a federal amendment, and it'll supersede all the other state laws. So that's where the federal amendment soon gets introduced into Congress in 1878, and then it's stalled there for 40 years.
What about in Ohio, Megan?
There are many attempts. So as part of also like the state by state, then there was also like, let's try it at the municipal level. Let's try it multiple levels. And, you know, Ohio goes through probably no less than six different attempts. And after the Constitution was changed, where an amendment can go to the electorate, there's two failed attempts at the general election for Ohio women to vote.
Katie, thanks for the call and that distinction. It's important. You're right. We will continue our conversation. We're going to bring in a historian in who has written about this issue and experienced it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the 19th Amendment and how the suffragists' fight for equality at the ballot box often pushed women of color out of the way. Led mostly by white women of means, the suffrage movement needed the support of minority women, but often shunned their active participation. Black suffragists such as Ida B. Wells, Haley Quinn Brown, and Mary Church Terrell forged their own paths, but the history books long ignored those contributions. That's starting to change. As journalist Elaine Weiss mentioned earlier, she's author of the 2018 book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Also with us, Megan Wood. She's director of cultural resources at the Ohio History Connection. Historian Tammy Brown is an assistant professor in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies at Miami University in Ohio. In 2018, she wrote a piece for the American Civil Liberties Union titled "Celebrate Women's Suffrage, But Don't Whitewash the Movement's Racism." We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Tammy Brown.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
One of the things I love about that piece, of course, is that you made it personal.
Yes, I think it's very important to keep track of everyday people, because when we talk about the suffrage movement, we often talk about the public figures. Of course, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and then if we're talking about African-American suffragists, Ida B. Wells, Sojourner Truth, etc., and they are, of course, important, but I think we also have to be mindful of how did this affect everyday people. So my great aunt, her name is Para Lee Wilmer, and she is now 95 years old, and she's a storyteller. I appreciate how she shares with me her lived experience growing up in Millers Ferry, Alabama, in a very large family, the daughter of sharecroppers, and the tensions and racism she experienced, including the landowner of the farm, the white landowner, telling her parents that their kids should be working all day on the plantation, or technically plantation is not the word, right? But working all day on the farm instead of going to school. And my aunt tells me how they resisted that racism in different ways. And one way was participating in the Great Migration. So she moved from Millers Ferry, Alabama, to Selma, Alabama with her sister, and then joined another older sister in Cincinnati. And that would be 1944. She voted for the first time after she moved to Cincinnati.
That is, you know, that experience, you're right. The personal stories are so important, Tammy Brown.
Yes. I think the personal is political. That is very much a theme of the women's rights movements over time, right? Your lived experience reflects the politics of the time.
Is it Mary Shelton White, Elaine Weiss?
Sue Shelton
mm-hmm. White, mm-hmm. Is she the one who had that experience as a child where she had a very political activist family and were talking politics and everyone went off to vote, but her mom didn't. And she realized.
No, that's actually that's Carrie Chapman Catt.
Sorry, I keep mixing everybody up. But yeah.
And again, absolutely right, Tammy. The personal does become political. One of the things I noticed in trying to delve into the lives of these women is that it's often a moment, a personal moment, often in childhood, where they realize something is wrong. Society is not treating women or black women the same, and they're going to do something about it. And it was just fascinating to track those moments that they would remember and describe as adults. Like, that was the moment I realized I was going to have to devote myself to this. And yeah, she realizes her mother is not old, can't vote because no women can vote at this time. This is in Iowa in the third quarter of the 19th century. And then she devotes her life to it. And it happens over and over again with these women, and they're brought into a larger movement. They learn. There's a mentoring system. They learn from their older activist colleagues. So it's a very interesting thing to watch this movement grow organically across the nation and realize it was not easy to do. You know, it was not like just putting on your pink pussy hat and going off to a march. You were often vilified in your community. Your pastor would denounce you from the pulpit. The local newspaper would write nasty things about you. Your club members, if you belong to a women's club, might shun you. The suffragists are attacked. They are pelted with vegetables and rotten eggs. They are imprisoned and tortured there. So it is not an easy thing to make this decision.
To add to that, if you don't mind,
yeah, sure.
I think the experience of African American women is particularly important to think about compounded racism and sexism and how those oppressions intersect. In my article, I talk about the term intersectionality. Mm-hmm. It's a term coined by legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw, and she talks about how different types of discrimination, oppression intersect in unique ways that oppress black women. So in addition to white suffragists being attacked, for black women, they were also, and for African Americans in general, they were also terrorized. Okay, take for example the 15th Amendment, which technically forbade discrimination based on race. But when African American men attempted to vote, there were different practices of literal intimidation in which white racist people in their neighborhoods would come to them and try to scare them, mm-hmm. and in worst case scenarios use violence and murder to prevent elite African Americans or educated African Americans and just African Americans in general from gaining progress. Ida B. Wells' activism is very much connected to this awareness because she took on her anti-lynching campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Once she realized this accusation of the myth of the black male rapist was the reason for why so many black men were being lynched. So as the story went, they would allege that a black man tried to flirt with a white woman or, you know, make a pass or smile at a white woman and even try to rape a white woman, but the majority of the black men lynched were actually successful business owners, as was the case for Ida B. Wells' friend who had a grocery store in competition with another white man. So I think whenever we're talking about a historical movement, we have to think about intersectionality. So how does racism intersect with sexism so that it made Ida B. Wells' experience during the 1913 march very different from that of white suffragists? I think of that history in terms of tragedy and triumph. So the tragedy of 1913 is Ida B. Wells and her contingent of African-American women were ready to march for women's rights, for equality, but they were asked to march at the back of the line to appease white Southerners, white Southern women who were there. The triumph of that moment is Ida B. Wells refused to march at the back of the line and joined her Illinois delegation as she planned. So to have that type of courage, intelligence, and persistence, it cannot be understated because African-American women were experiencing multiple types of oppression. And you can add to that intersectionality in addition to racism, sexism, mm-hmm. classism, you know, and other isms, depending on where you're born and raised in the country, whether you're a northerner or a southerner, et cetera.
Determined to a large extent the kind of support you got from your community, from your spouse.
Right.
From your family.
Mm-hmm.
It was different. You say that a nation, Tammy, built on stolen land from Native Americans and stolen labor from African slaves is flawed from the start. And we've talked about that. You said we must constantly acknowledge this truth and engage in that intersectional celebration of women's rights activists and landmark events. And we acknowledge this truth and engage in that celebration, but it's also kind of mourning it as well, what could have been.
I think that's a good point. There are moments in 1913, the march is a moment in which I see potential, and then you're let down by the brutality, the truth of racism in America. But this shows you how complicated the history is, because if we're thinking about the personal is political, the political is personal, the politics of race also interfered with friendships. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, they were friends with Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, mm-hmm. who supported women's suffrage and white women's suffrage. But when it became a question of would black men get the vote before white women, they changed. They switched teams and they began to use racist rhetoric, saying things like, why would you want these men who are considered inferior to get the right to vote before your noble sisters and mothers? And that's when you see the politics of race getting in the way of potential allies, potential partnerships.
Yeah. I just want to complicate things a little more.
Okay, thanks, Elaine.
and Tammy, you're absolutely, you know, right that there's that heartbreaking split after women are left out of the 15th Amendment,
right.
Which says only covers only black men, and
right.
they and Frederick Douglass, who by the way is at Seneca Falls,
mm-hmm.
It's Seneca. It's he who convinces the other really reluctant participants to support the idea of demanding women's suffrage, and he is the great universal suffragist. I think he's probably the hero of my book. But it's also true that he was deeply, deeply disappointed by the powers that be pitting the women and the black men against one another. And we see this happen all the time, saying right. only one of you can succeed in this. And Sojourner Truth is horrified by this only one can get through the gates, as they said. And she says, I am subjugated twice over as a black right. woman and as an African immigrant and as a woman. And so you see this terrible break, and they do use vile language and suggestion in those first years. But what you also have to understand is their friendship was maintained with Frederick Douglass. Mm-hmm. And Susan Anthony stays at his house in Anacostia when she visits Washington, D.C., and his widow invites Susan Anthony and Stanton to be eulogists at his funeral. So it's complicated.
Yeah,
it is complicated.
And I think after the passage of the amendment, you see the struggle for African-Americans to continue to try to vote and African-American women to try to vote. And I think the disappointment that the white suffragists do not, you know,
pursue that.
Yeah, they don't pursue that, you know, with the same vigor that they pursued the vote, and then that some continue for the Equal Rights Amendment. And it reminds me of at the Women's March, a woman holding up a sign saying, see y'all at the next Black Lives Matter rally, right? And, you know, sort of this, what this means to be a feminist.
In other words, you're welcome to the larger fold, but does the larger fold show up for you?
Right.
Tammy Brown? Mm-hmm. Tammy Brown?
Me?
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yep, now I can.
Okay, that's an excellent point. I just participated in a conversation at the Freedom Center, the National Underground Railroad Museum in Cincinnati, Ohio, and one of the panelists made the same point when I asked the question, if we consider the differing and overlapping experiences of oppression, let's say that black women have with white women, can they be true allies? Can they show up for each other? And one of the panelists said, you know, the question is, will white women show up as allies for black women and just African Americans if there's nothing that they have to gain?
Nothing in it for them.
Yes, other than to stand in solidarity. That is the question.
In other words, there's still this other.
Yes, and it's still highlighting the long-standing split within feminist movements between African-American feminists and white feminists who have tried to talk to each other over the past decades and decades. Sometimes they get common ground, they find common ground, but oftentimes when African-American feminists talk about the need for white women to listen to them and to support African-American women in the same way, bell hooks writes about this, the feminist scholar bell hooks writes about black women trying to have an open and honest dialogue with white women feminists, but unfortunately sometimes they become too defensive or it just falls apart because of their different lived experiences and sometimes just the inability to imagine yourself in someone else's shoes or to just stand in solidarity with someone else because it's the right thing to do.
Well, Tammy Brown, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Historian Tammy Brown is an assistant professor in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies at Miami University in Ohio. In 2018, she wrote a piece for the American Civil Liberties Union titled Celebrate Women's Suffrage, But Don't Whitewash the Movement's Racism. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, Elaine Weiss, a journalist and author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be with you.
And Megan Wood, Director of Cultural Resources for the Ohio History Connection. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.